Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself.
With gratitude to Shahana Rahman of Rahman Lawn, San Francisco, California, for waiting for me to get set up here in Indianapolis, I was finally able to record our long-scheduled podcast. As such, I can finally show you the very genuine, kind person I've had the chance to work with for these last couple of years. At long last, I'm able to show you a woman who mixes professionalism with warmth in her important service to cyclists who've been compromised by motorists. Hey, how you doing today, Shahana?
I'm doing great, Martin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. We're just going to jump right into it because there's so much about Shahana Rahman that I need for the guy that bicycles down the street to be able to understand. So, Shahana, before we get into bikes and law, where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Long Island, New York.
Yeah, was there a city out there that you grew up in?
Sure, Massapequa, Nassau County.
Massapequa, huh? Okay.
Massapequa.
Did you ride a bike there much?
I did. I had my first, bought my first red Schwinn.
Yeah.
When I was a kid with some babysitting money, I think. It wasn't my first bike, but it was the first bike I bought myself.
Really? Was it like a Schwinn Varsity or something like that?
It was a baby bike, so it wasn't even a 10-speed. The Varsity was the second one. But it was a Schwinn. It was like a fake Schwinn with no handbrakes. It was like an OG fixie for a child.
So it was a coaster brake. You step on the backwards pedal.
Yeah.
Really?
Huh. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah. But it had hoods and everything. It was bright red.
Where'd you get the money for it? You bought it. Did you have a paper route or something? Oh, you did. You had a paper route?
My brother had a paper route. I would help him, and we'd split it.
Uh-huh.
And then we were industrious as kids because we grew up kind of poor.
God bless paper, buddy.
Do our jobs and make money.
Yeah, wow. It's like I can't tell you how many bikes and things I bought with paper route money. You know, kids don't have that luxury anymore. So
no more paper route.
Yeah, geez, isn't that wild?
Yeah.
I guess probably I'm going to skip maybe a few years. You were a kid in Long Island. Was there a lot of riding around there?
Yeah.
Did you ride much?
A lot of riding. We used to ride bikes. That was our freedom, you know.
Really?
Every day.
Really?
It was the time when you just get on your bike. We were, 6, 7, 8. And our parents didn't care. We'd ride a group and we'd go all through the neighborhood. No, back then, no helmets, no nothing.
Uh-huh.
But big wide streets and it was safe. And it was a thing that our parents would let us do without.
All right. Did you ever go on long rides in Long Island?
Yeah, we used to our long ride during the summer. We'd ride out to Jones Beach.
Uh-huh. Jones Beach. Huh?
10 or 15 miles, Jones Beach.
Wow.
In the heat of the summer,
Did you ever make it up to Port Jefferson?
We couldn't ride that far.
That's too far, huh? How long is Long Island anyway? Just curious, about 100 miles? No, 50 miles?
It's probably at least 100 miles all the way out to the point.
Yeah, I guess that'd be right. Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, like, you were riding your bike all the way through as a kid. Did you ride in high school, too?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I rode in high school.
Right.
And when I lived in New York in high school, I used to ride my bike in the snow to get to the bus to take us to high school. That was my Schwinn Varsity.
That was in New York City, then?
No, it was still in Long Island.
In Long Island still. Okay. So you used to ride... Used to ride your bike to school, or ride your bike to school and
the bus to get to school.
Really? How cool is that? Yeah, Schwinn Varsity when you're doing that. That's great. And what was the name of your high school just for fun?
Massapequa High School.
Ah, so okay. How about college? Where'd you go to college at?
Then we moved out to California, and I went to college at Santa Clara.
Yeah. Your whole family moved out there?
Yep.
And was
yep.
did you live in Santa? Down. Did you live in Santa Clara?
We moved out to Santa Cruz, and then
You're
I went to college
me.
In Santa Clara.
So you were in San Francisco, Santa Cruz, in the early 90s, possibly too.
I moved out of there '90, right after the earthquake.
Oh, you did. Okay, the '89 earthquake. Yeah. You were gone, yeah. huh? So you weren't there that
yeah.
long.
Just no, couple... I was there about 3-4 years.
Yeah,
and then I
right.
lived my first year of college. I lived in Santa Cruz and commuted, and that was the year of the earthquake. And so I was
okay.
over the hill when Highway 17 was basically closed.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I rode my bike on that one. It was very, very surreal experience right after the earthquake.
Yeah.
That was crazy, crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
So you're a Santa Cruz kid. Kind of, sort of. Wow.
Kind of, sort of.
Wow. That's amazing. You went to Santa Clara. Went to school with the Jesuits.
I did.
Wow.
They had the best bar. No one knows this, but the Jesuit residence, maybe still does, had the most elaborate, most impressive bar I've ever seen.
You're kidding me. That's on campus?
No. On campus.
Really?
The big Jesuit residence where the Jesuits lived. It was elaborate.
So what do you mean by that? It was like a bar that drinking for alcohol?
Right. It was like a parlor room.
Uh-huh.
Like a fancy parlor room with like a mahogany bar and just fancy.
And anybody could use it, huh?
Not exactly. You had to be invited by the Jesuits.
It wasn't just any student at Santa Clara could go to the Jesuit bar. It was like you had to be invited by the priests. Gotcha.
Yes.
Wow. Too wild. And then you went from a Catholic Santa Clara, Catholic school, to a Catholic law school, correct?
I did.
And that
and
was
all
where?
All Jesuit education, University of San Francisco.
Okay. Wow. So you went from Santa Cruz to Santa Clara to San Francisco, all the way up the peninsula. And ended up stuck in San Francisco. We spoke the other day, you were doing personal injury law. So you started doing personal injury law for the longshoremen back pretty much when they ran San Francisco. Now, you were saying that you came on board with them when they were starting to shut the ports down. Is that correct? And can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's right. It was put myself in law school. I took a job working for a guy who represented longshoremen when they got hurt at work. So it was more like workers' comp for longshoremen. And it was at a time, it wasn't the heyday of longshoremen. It was when they were starting to close the ports.
Right.
So those jobs were getting a little bit more scarce. So these were almost all men, but some women these folks really, really, really wanted to work. And so even when they were hurt, really bad things. Bad things would happen to longshoremen. They would get stuck in a hole and covered with product. They would have pallets fall on them. They would have limbs ripped off. Some bad injuries. And
tell us about the path you took before you started fighting for the rights of cyclists. When did you become a bike commuter, and how did all that kind of stuff evolved?
It's hard to say. I grew up riding a bike, obviously, and then when I lived in Santa Clara through college, there was great bike riding in Santa Clara. To and from school and around, because big flat wide streets, and back then not a lot of traffic there. And then, after I moved up to San Francisco, I didn't ride for a while because it was kind of terrifying to me. So I didn't have a lot of time because I was in law school and starting my first law job. So I was working probably 60, 70, 90 hours a week, And then when I got my first plaintiff's job working for a firm representing injured people, I started doing a lot of bicycle and motorcycle cases, so representing the rights of cyclists and motorcyclists. And that's when I started getting back on the bike in San Francisco.
Okay, great. And were you remember the SFBC back then?
I became a member of the SFBC when I opened my firm about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what, that would have been 2004, 2007 or so?
2007, yeah.
Okay, great.
Yep.
And now, so were you active with the SFBC?
I have been active with them for the last 10 years. I've had the pleasure of sponsoring a number of their programs over the years.
Uh-huh.
And attending all their great events. And the most recent thing I've been doing with them is sponsoring a fairly new program. It's their Women Who Ride program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically sort of a social and educational program for women riders.
Mm-hmm.
So they
Great.
Do group rides, and they also put on presentations about things that might be relevant to riders.
Uh-huh. Awesome. Wow. So how do you feel about riding in San Francisco now? Have you gotten over your fear?
I have gotten over my fear. It took some time, but I would force myself to, 8-9 years ago, ride up and down Market Street.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the way back then to get over your fear.
No kidding.
Just riding. down Market Street is actually almost pleasurable. Not totally, but there's been so many great improvements.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It took a lot. But SFBC was really helpful there, mm-hmm. because it gave me a community of people who could share stories and, mm-hmm. Tell you what the best route is, or, gives you that kind of help, I think.
Awesome.
So city riding was very different from what I'd been used to.
Uh-huh.
It's not big, wide open streets with very few cars. It's the very opposite of that. So it was really learning how to navigate urban riding.
As well as the railroad tracks.
Right. 90 degrees. 90 degrees.
Which is, boy, I'll tell you, I've seen that. I've seen so many people go down on those things, It's just,
yep.
It's hysterical. And it's funny. And even sometimes I've seen seasoned cyclists go down because they've let their guard down. They've kind of, you got to hit them perfectly 90 degrees, like you say.
Yep.
Okay. Now, in terms of your service, Shahana, it's free.
Yes.
But, of yes. course, that's if you choose to take on someone's case. How does one get that ball rolling? You do a couple of interviews, one on the phone, one face-to-face. Tell us about that. About those.
Sure. I'll clarify a little bit. My service is not actually free. There is no upfront cost. I'm a contingency fee lawyer. Like all personal injury lawyers, we take a percentage of recovery.
Okay. So
how people get to me, people come to me. Most of my cases are referred through former clients, friends, and also I get a lot of cases referred to me from defense attorneys, the folks I argue against in cases. So that's how I get my cases, and people come to me and they call or they send an email through our website. And then some people we then call people back who have seemed like they might have a viable case. And there's a phone process where we take a little bit of information through. If they come in through the website has a number of standard questions that help us better evaluate. So that's an easier process. And then either through the website intake process or the phone intake process, it looks like it might be a case that I can take on. I have folks come in and we meet in person.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what kinds of factors come into play in your determining whether a case is worth representing?
There are a lot of different factors. One, and probably the biggest one, is you know, I want to make sure if the case meets all the criteria, you know, there was a collision or there was an injury and there are certain parameters met, I want to make sure that my involvement is going to add value to that client. Okay. And so for the bike community, I get a lot of calls from cyclists who were in some sort of collision, but thankfully either were not injured or just had property damage or damaged their bikes. And they call really because they don't know what their rights are or what should happen. And so for those folks, I will just take them through the process. And if it's a very minor injury, I'll take them through the process of how to do it themselves, because that's not the case where I would add value for them. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's something, not every case, you don't need a lawyer for every case. Some,
right.
Because there's insurance on the other side. You can sometimes work it out with the insurance company, although the insurance companies do not play fair. If you at least are armed with sort of the basic information about how these things work, mm-hmm. it can help you just resolve your issue on your own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You were saying also that you kind of look at the client and see if they're able to enunciate and express themselves appropriately. And if it's something to do with, like, if they're just trying to do this out of an ego type spite thing or talk about that just a little bit.
Sure. You always want, because the personal injury in the civil lawsuit system is pretty narrow in what I can do. So essentially what we can do is get monetary recovery for people who are injured, right? And that's money. Mm-hmm. And so if someone comes to me and they want something other than that, you know, they want to be vindicated or they want to be right, or that motivation is difficult because it's not the thing that the system allows me to do for them. So I look at that.
Okay. Yeah.
I also always meet with clients because I think it's really important. I spend a lot of time with my clients and I want to make sure we gel, right? That mm-hmm. I like them and they like me. Mm-hmm. And because it's an important relationship like any other relationship, mm-hmm. you're in a position where you both are sharing sensitive and important information and you need to trust each other. Mm-hmm. So I think the client meeting is really important to that process to sort of assess how someone is going to be, whether or not they can withstand the kind of rigors of litigation if that's necessary. Because having a lawsuit and having a claim, you know, it's not a fun process for people. You know, myself and my staff, we try to make it as painless as possible, but there's still an element of having to participate in reliving the horrible thing that happened to you, right? And so there are some people who I feel going through that process is actually going to be worse for them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I got it. Okay. So once you choose to take on a case, a pretty big mechanism gets set into place. It becomes far more than Shahana Rahman. Tell us about your staff.
Sure. I have three wonderful women who work with me. I have Christina Guido. She's my director of client services. And she is sort of, she's me when I can't be available. In terms of being able to be responsive to the clients, she gets information from them, gives them information about what's going to happen next, or gives them documents to review, and kind of also handles the initial process between potential clients and what's to become new clients. And Christina is a fabulous woman. She is, I'll give you a little bit of her back. Well, I'll tell you one personal thing about her. She's a phenomenal gospel and choir singer in her personal life. So she's a very interesting woman. And then I have Jaylon, who is my case manager. And so Jaylon runs, she runs also the office functionality and make sure we have the things we need to do our jobs, but also keeps track of the status of cases, make sure they're moving along, and coordinates scheduling with the opposing parties. And so basically keeps us on track. And then I also have Anya, who's a paralegal, but also a lawyer by training, who graduated from Bolt. And okay. Anya works with me. So she works with me on sort of the nitty-gritty legal issues sometimes, mm-hmm. and gets documents together, and we work on preparing discovery, the litigation aspects of a case once a case mm-hmm. is filed.
Wow. Impressivo. So you, going beyond that, you told me you're kind of a youngish clientele, the people that work, that come before you tend to be younger folks, millennials, as it were, possibly, and they're more comfortable with a paperless legal trail. Can you provide paper documents to those who need them?
Of course. Okay. You know, my clientele has changed over the years, so there's a mix. But yeah, so we've adopted some technology in the last couple of years to be more efficient internally and also make the process easier for clients. And that is largely a paperless system, but I always adapt my processes to my clients. So if I have clients who don't, I have clients who don't use email. And so we don't use email.
Whoa.
We just call. Or we have in-person appointments.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's fine. And I have clients who only want to be contacted by text message. And mm-hmm. we do that too. Mm-hmm. And then I have clients who want old fashioned, you know, they want documents in the mail, and I'm happy to send, you know, whatever it is, because at the end of the day, you want them to feel comfortable.
Uh-huh,
and so whatever's
uh-huh.
going to make them comfortable, whatever's going to make them engaged in their process, in their case, I want to do.
Okay. You've got a web portal you were talking about that's your
yes.
clients that are comfortable with tech. They can stay in real time mm-hmm. by, it's a cutting edge web portal. You've had a lot of success with that. Tell us about that, about the web portal.
Sure. That's a piece of technology or software, I guess, that has been kind of important, I think, to changing a lot of inefficiency in client communication. The portal is essentially clients get a login and a password, and it's also a cloud-based program and also a phone app if you want that. And you log in to your case file. And so there we can message each other and see our chain of messages, but also I can upload documents for them to see or hearings that are going to be set, and they can upload documents they want me to see, and we can communicate that way. And it's, first of all, tremendously more secure than email, and because a lot of the information we're sharing, medical records, you know, paycheck stubs, things that are personally identifiable information mm-hmm. So sensitive, the portal gives us that extra security measure. And also for ease of use, we're just in one place, and so we can have basically a conversation that is that we can both refer back to.
Great.
Versus email becomes very difficult because there's a tremendous back and forth and it sits there. In the portal, the messages don't sit there. You're alerted, so you know it's a client who's important. Like for me, my inbox was not just clients. It was, you know, 1,000 other people who were not
right.
clients. And so right. it became hard, you know. So the clients are the most important. So to cull them from all these people sending me email was
uh-huh.
difficult. And this, to me, this gives me my priority folks, my clients in one place. So, and clients love it too,
wow.
because they don't have to scan, you know, they don't have to email a bunch of things one at a time. They can just upload documents and it's pretty seamless.
Wow. Are other law firms using this web portal?
Yeah. They must be, because it's a product they sell to lawyers. So
mm-hmm.
I assume, otherwise they'd be out of business.
But is it popular? I've never heard of this before. Is it a popular system?
I don't know. I don't know. And none of my colleagues are using it, so I don't know. It doesn't. It's a little bit not. I think folks are a little bit reluctant from the lawyer standpoint to use it because it's different. And people are very comfortable with email.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why it is kind of cutting edge, pretty much. Would that be correct to say?
I don't know how cutting it is. It's been around for a long time, and I don't know what to do with it, but employers, you know, a lot of lawyers are stuck in thinking about how we've always done things, which have been very paper-driven, paper-intensive. Mm. And so you have to kind of reassess and kind of reevaluate your processes to meet demand, I think. But,
okay. Wow. Now, you also have an office in Paso Robles. Why?
I do.
Why? What are you doing down there?
A few years ago, I decided, because I've lived in San Francisco for 25 years, I decided that I was going to buy a farm, a small farm down in Paso Robles, and have another office down there, because it's a nice respite from the city and also great biking community down here. And it was just something that I wanted to do. I wanted to have, an alternative to urban life.
So are you living on a farm?
I spend, I split my time between the two places, and I have a small place on a piece of land.
Wow, how cool is that? So we're looking, we're talking to a farming lawyer, huh?
Right.
How cool is that? How far is that from San Francisco?
About 200 miles.
200 miles? Okay. And what's the drive like to and fro? Is it Highway 1? Highway 1 or Highway 101?
101.
Okay, so it's a little more tolerable, huh? In terms of time. Wow. So, so do you find that while your team does its work and the busyness of San Francisco, that you get a better big picture view of what your clients need back in the city by going for a drive to your office down south?
The way that we work now is so different, because we can work from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And because my practice has always required a certain amount of travel, you know, I've done cases all throughout California, right? So Northern and Southern California, up north. So it allows me to have the office in that midway point, gives me more flexibility in the kind of cases and location of cases I can take, and having good people who work with me manage the day-to-day and keep things running, of course, is allows me to do the legal work and do the thing that I'm good at.
Wow. So you've expanded your reach, huh?
I've always done cases. I didn't really expand my reach, except that I now have a midway point to do that from. It encourages me more to take cases, from the end of the peninsula down to LA, down to Santa Barbara, that I might not otherwise have taken because of the distance.
So are you doing anything in SoCal at all?
Yep. I've got a couple cases down there going now. Mostly focused on Paso Robles. And San Luis Obispo County.
Gee, we need Christmas. So you were telling me the other day that most of your work is in San Francisco, Oakland, Marin County. Is that not correct?
That has been historically what it's been. Mm-hmm. Until in my younger years, it was a wider swath. And so the last few years, I focused on those areas because those are the cases that I was, those are the circles of cases I was getting. Mm-hmm. And then expanding down to San Luis Obispo County, that's kind of opened up the scope of areas of cases that I do.
So are you doing anything in San Luis O?
Yeah.
College town?
My office here.
Yeah.
My office here is fully functional, and
when I say San Luis, I meant was like, you say San Luis Obispo County, Paso Robles yes. is a city in Cielo County, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, and then there's the actual city of San Luis Obispo and where yes. the college is at. Do you do work there as well?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
you do? Great. Awesome. Okay. Now, with regard to San Francisco, Oakland, Marin County, tell us about the bike organizations you support there besides the SFBC.
Sure. I've supported Bike East Bay for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And also the Marin County Bike Coalition, I've had a pretty special and longstanding relationship with. Marin County, especially, I've done a lot of different sponsorships with them over the years. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Bike to Work Day, we get to be on the bridge, on the Golden Gate Bridge on Bike to Work Day with uh-huh. the great folks from MCBC. At 5:30 in the morning when it's dark and freezing cold on the bridge. That's the highlight of the year.
Uh-huh.
Totally fun. Which is almost, it was often on my birthday, so that uh-huh. also is fun. Last year was on my birthday. So,
wow.
MCBC does a lot of great educational things uh-huh. too. And so I was fortunate they had, they do a bicycle citation sort of forgiveness mm-hmm. training, mm-hmm. if you will. Where if you're a bicycle in Marin County, you get cited for an infraction, you can go to this educational class, like an hour, 2 hours long, and get your ticket written off. And so I was able
really?
To sponsor their program,
cool.
that program for a number of years.
Wow. How awesome is that? You were saying there are other programs right now that you're active with the Marin County folks also. There is the citation one. There's also something else that you were talking, something to do with women, I think, or no, or was
that? That was the SFBC we talked about, yeah.
Great, awesome, wow. That's so cool. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything I've missed? Anything you'd like to add?
I think you got it all, Martin. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Well, I thank you for you taking your time to kind of help us understand your service, because it's an important one. Essentially, I'm happy you're helping be able to show the important service for those of us on bikes. We have to have a need for it, God forbid, that you're out there, and you're a real bullet cyclist, and that's exciting. So I'm very, very fired up to be able to show the listenership out there that Shahana Robin is who she is and why I like working with her and why I've always thought she was an amazing peep. And so that's it. I probably should just say, see you later, Shahana. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Martin.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG
or
to access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.